All right, well, here we're in chapter 25 of Exodus. We're making our way through Exodus, and I wanted to just stop and just kind of provide an overview of where we are, just from like kind of like an outline perspective. So in the first 18 chapters of Exodus, we cover the redemption, and really Exodus is broken down into three major divisions. The first is what I just mentioned, the redemption, and this is where the Lord delivered Israel out of slavery in Egypt, using Moses as the leader of the people. And so we saw how the Lord did that in a mighty way. In the second part, which we just covered, chapters 19 through 24, we see God making a covenant with his people. And we saw as we went through those chapters that God, you know, laid out the Ten Commandments. You know, he prepared the people to receive the Ten Commandments, and then he provided those. He provided the judgments that went along with it. And those two things, you know, the Ten Commandments and the judgments, we talked about how they collectively comprise what's called the Book of the Covenant. And then we saw the Lord confirming the covenant with the people. In other words, there was almost like this formal entry into this covenant, or this set of promises, or you can even call it a contract or an agreement. So we saw that happening. We saw that. We talked about how, you know, the Lord had, you know, the commandments and the judgments and all, but he didn't force it on the people. He allowed them to decide if they wanted to accept it, and they did. And so there was that formal process where the covenant was accepted and they entered into it. And so now for the balance of the book of Exodus, chapters 25 through 40, we're going to talk about the tabernacle. And this is really where God provides a way to dwell with his people. And so in this section, first we're going to see that where God will provide instructions through Moses to the people in terms of the tabernacle itself and the furnishings for the tabernacle. He's going to give instructions for the priests beginning in chapter 28. And then there's going to be kind of an interruption where there's going to be some rebellion where Israel is involved in idolatry with the golden calf, which is something that is familiar to all of us. I'm pretty sure of that. And then there's a confirmation of a covenant, you know, after they had that that lapse, so to speak. And then we're going to see from chapters 35 through 40 where the tabernacle is actually constructed using the instructions that the Lord provided to Moses. The priestly garments are made, and we're going to see that after all that is put together, that God's glory fills the tabernacle. What we're going to see through all of this is something kind of a theme that we've been talking about, and that is how much of what we have been covering in Exodus, it's really a shadow of the things to come. And we know that the things to come are things concerning Christ. So all of the things that we're looking at, they all are a picture of or a shadow of Christ. But one of the things that I just would want to throw out as just by way of reminder, and that is that when we are talking about a shadow, we're talking about, you know, a shadow. If you think about it, you know, you have something, right? It could be a person, or it could be an object. It could be, you know, a tree or a building or whatever that's casting a shadow. So when you look at the shadow, you can get a sense for the actual thing that is being sort of reflected. But the shadow is not that thing. Okay, so that's the important thing. So what we're looking at, it's not the genuine article. It's not the actual thing. It's a shadow of Christ, and Christ is the real thing. He is the substance. And that's why, it's really important that we kind of, kind of keep that in mind, because this is what, when we get into Hebrews, which we already covered, that's when, the writer of Hebrews is showing how, you guys are holding on, to the shadow instead of holding on to the genuine article, the actual one, Jesus Christ. And so that's something I kind of wanted to clarify. So here in chapter 25, as we begin into these chapters, chapters 25 through 40, that's describing the tabernacle, we see here a very detailed description of all the things that are going on with the tabernacle. In fact, it is the most detailed description of anything that is described in the Bible. So we can take from that this is a really important thing, this tabernacle. And we're going to see that there are seven times, and not all seven of those times are mentioned in the book of Exodus, but there are seven times where the Lord will be saying to Moses that it is important, Moses, that you do everything related to the construction of this tabernacle and all of the instruments or furnishings in this tabernacle exactly according to the pattern that I'm going to show you. And that is something that, as I said, is repeated. It's super important. And the reason why is because, again, in the very last verse of the last chapter, chapter 24, in verse 18, it talked about how Moses went into the midst of the cloud, and he went up into the mountain. And then the last sentence says, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So something took place in those 40 days and 40 nights. And what, among other things, God revealed to Moses a heavenly tabernacle. So in other words, Moses was likely shown the actual tabernacle in heaven, basically. And so it was revealed to him, and so in relation to this, it's going to be revealed, all of this detail about how he is to construct this tabernacle that is, again, a picture of the genuine article, that this place that actually is in heaven. And so he's given all of these measurements in precision, every color, every detail that is to be involved in this tabernacle, which is this place of worship. And what we have here is, as I said before, this is God providing a way to dwell with his people. And this is really the first time that God will take up his presence in the midst of his people since way back in like the first, couple of chapters of Genesis, where he was had open fellowship with Adam and Eve. And what we said, as we covered those chapters in Genesis, and we've said a number of times, that if you look at those first few pages of the Bible, before man fell, that really gives you a good picture of what God, what he intended, what he wanted, and that is to be in fellowship and communion with man. But the problem is that man messed it up, right? Because we sinned, and as a result, we had to be, Adam and Eve, they had to be driven out, and the Lord immediately put in place a plan to reconcile and to get back to that place there in the first part of Genesis. And we saw that when we were in Revelation, and I will likely allude to that a little bit later this evening. So Moses undoubtedly heard and he saw glorious things when he was there with the Lord on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. But like Paul, do you remember when Paul talked about how he was taken into heaven? Like he actually, there was a time when he was beaten like to and to death almost basically. And he was, you know, unconscious. And he, you know, he said that he was taken into heaven and he saw things that it would be unlawful for him to speak about, okay? Because he wouldn't be able to do it justice. And so he knew that he was not to speak about it. Well, similarly, we don't see Moses talking about what he saw, you know, when he was there, those 40 days and 40 nights. But what he does do is he writes what he was told to speak to the people and these precise instructions here. And so that's what we're really going to talk about here. But I think the general point that we would make is that here the Lord has provided the people with the Ten Commandments, and he said there's this agreement and they are to obey those commandments. But the reality is that their obedience is not enough. Okay, this their simple obedience is not enough. God also wants our worship as well. We are to worship him. And a part of that, a big part of that, is that worshiping the Lord actually is for our good, okay? Because he is the true and the living God. And so we are to worship him. Now, one of the other things that comes to mind in this on this point is that if you think about the Ten Commandments themselves, the very first commandment, which you would regard as the most important because it comes first in the order, is that we are not to have any gods before the true and the living God. We're not to make any graven images or anything else like that to worship them. And right, so, but then the issue is that there is within man a natural inclination to worship, right? And so, in essence, in creating this tabernacle, not only does the Lord, what he's really doing here is to he wants to dwell with his people, but it also, he provides instructions and he shows them what appropriate worship would be of him, right? And so that is the a significant point. Now, before we go in and we launch into chapter 25 in terms of beginning to look at the detailed instructions, I want to try to describe this tabernacle that the Lord is giving Moses instructions to build. And unfortunately, you know, I didn't have the correct technology, you know, to put it up on the screen, but I'll try to describe what it is. So the tabernacle itself is a relatively small structure. Okay. It's a rectangular structure that is 15 feet wide by 45 feet long. Okay, so if you can just imagine a structure like that. And within that structure, there are two compartments or two rooms, so to speak. One room, which is the larger room, is 15 by 30. So in essence, that larger room is two-thirds of the size of the entire tabernacle. And that room is called the Holy Place. Okay. And then the smaller room is 15 by 15. And that room is called the Most Holy Place. All right. In the smaller room, the most holy place is where the Ark of the Covenant is placed. And then in that larger room, there are three things. One is the altar of incense, the table of the bread of the presence, and the lampstand. And so that's what, when we talk about the tabernacle, that's really what we're speaking about. Now, surrounding the tabernacle is an outer court. And that outer court is 75 feet wide. It's also rectangular in shape. It's 75 feet wide and it's 150 feet long. And in there are two things. One is a laver. It's made out of bronze. And it is a place where it's like a big gigantic bowl, right? Where there's water in there and their ceremonial washings were taking place because the priests were commanded to continually wash their hands and their feet during the tabernacle services. And then there's also an altar of burnt offering, and that's where they would do the burnt offerings. And so that is, hopefully you can kind of picture that in your mind. And maybe some of you have actually seen like pictures of what that looks like. And so now we have kind of the big picture, and now we can kind of go in and start to look at the detailed instructions that that the Lord gave to Moses. So let's look at chapter 25 of Exodus, and we'll start at verse 1. And it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel that they bring me an offering from everyone who gives it willingly with his heart. You shall take my offering.'" And so here he starts out, and there's quite a bit here actually where the Lord has spoken to Moses, and Moses is then relaying what the Lord told him. And he says, "I want you to go and speak to the children of Israel and essentially tell them that they are to bring to me an offering." But he only is requesting this offering from those among the people who would be giving it willingly. He was saying that, and then he says, with a willing heart, and it says, "You shall take my offering." And this is really, emblematic of the way that the Lord desires for us to give. It's never a situation where there is any kind of arm twisting or coercion or begging or anything else. It's not to be that way. It's really, as it said here, it's just merely speaking and in a sense giving people the opportunity to give. And it's never anything that is to be done grudgingly or under pressure or under any kind of compulsion. And we can see an example of really what that looks like in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. I think that verse really does sum up what approach we should have or what our heart should be with regard to giving. So 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 6 reads, "But this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully." And so first off, Paul in this letter to the Corinthians, he starts out with a law or a principle. And this law of sowing and reaping, it's like any other law that scientists have discovered, like the law of gravity, for instance, right? There is this law, which is that you reap what you sow. And so he says that if you're the kind of person who sows sparingly, then you're going to reap sparingly. And if you sow bountifully, you will reap bountifully. So that's the first principle that he lays out. But then in verse 7, he says, so let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. And so here he is laying out the heart that a giver should have, and that is that you know, it's based upon what you decide in your heart, you know, and that's based upon what the Lord may lay on your heart or just the you know, the what's coming out of your heart. Because in essence, as we're going to see, giving is an act of worship, essentially. And so it says here that it's not to be done grudgingly or of necessity. So like we're not to give and just be upset about it, or, you know, doing it like angrily or what have you, or doing it because of there's some need. If you notice here, when the Lord instructs Moses to have the people bring an offering, he doesn't tell them why they're there to bring an offering. So it's not like oh, we need this money or we need these things. And so that's a really important thing here, is that we're not to do it grudgingly or out of necessity. We have to understand that the Lord owns everything. Everything belongs to him. But what we can take from this and see if we think about it is that the Lord he gives us the opportunity to be blessed by giving, because it is more blessed to give than to receive, and to be involved in what the Lord is doing. And so he is giving us the opportunity. It's not like he needs this, okay? And so we're not giving it grudgingly out of necessity, but God, it says here, loves it when we give cheerfully or hilariously, like we're just really like we're enjoying it. It's something that is just it warms our heart to do. He loves it when a person's that way. And look at verse 8, which is an amazing statement. He says, and God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. And it's just another example of one of these wonderful sentences that Paul writes under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Notice like all those times when he uses the word all, you know, he's able to make all grace. And then, you know, so it's all grace, but then it's abounding towards us. So we got grace that's bounding towards us, that you always, you know, look how like, definitive that is, always having all sufficiency in all things. He's really just underscoring this, may have an abundance for every good work. And so notice how that ends, have an abundance for every good work. So I kind of take from that, you know, as we go along in life and we're living our life out for Christ, everything that we need in life just to sustain our life and to continue on doing God's will and having the resources to do what it is that the Lord has us to do, we will have an abundance of what we need. We'll never be lacking in that. And so going back to chapter 25 of Exodus, we see here that the Lord is telling Moses, hey, speak to the people and tell them to give, those who have a willing heart. And it says here to take, and that's really just to say to accept, right? To accept. And it says, my offering. And that's a key point, is that this offering and any offering that is given to the Lord, it belongs to him. It belongs to God. And so, you know, as a church, and especially as church leaders, there is a need to manage the offering that belongs to God, as it's a sacred trust that we have. And we will have to give an account for that. And so he starts out there and says, hey, you know, this is what we need you to do. And so then he goes on to talk about what would be included in this offering. It says, and this is the offering which you shall take from them: gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen and goat's hair, ram skins dyed red, badger skins and acacia wood, oil for the light and spices for the anointing oil and for the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set in the ephod and in the breastplate. And so here we see these materials, and they're very specific materials. And again, remember that what Moses is being instructed to construct is this place of meeting, this dwelling place for the Lord. But what it's going to be a almost like a replica of the of heaven, basically. And so these materials, they all there's symbolism there, and there is a picture involved in all of these different things. And I'll just give like some examples of that. So we see here, first of all, these precious metals here, right? So we have gold, and that is a picture of deity or holiness. So whenever you see gold, that is what it depicts in the Bible. The second is silver, and silver is a picture of redemption. And we know that because whenever there is redemption, there's a redemption price. That price is always paid in silver. So if there's an instruction to redeem your son or to redeem an ox, it's always the redemption price is in silver. And then bronze is a picture of judgment. And so all of these different metals are going to be used in different ways in this tabernacle and in the instruments that will be used in the tabernacle, and it will be representative of the things that I'm describing here. And then, like, for instance, like it's going to talk about things that are blue, and blue would be a symbol of heaven. Purple would be a symbol of royalty. Scarlet would be a symbol of redemption. So you can kind of get an idea with all of these different things that are being brought in you know, offered by the people. That's what they're going to be used for. And these are all really, you know, not only specific, but these are things that are kind of like precious in a way. Like, so for instance, like acacia wood is a wood that is a very durable, and it's also a precious wood. And so these are all like things that are valuable, I guess is what I want to say. And part of what is being offered here, the Israelites received when they were leaving out of Egypt. Remember when they were leaving towards the end there, the Lord told them to go to the Egyptians and ask them for, you know, gold and you know, jewelry and all this sort of thing. And so that part of what is being offered here is what they received there. Verse 8, it says, and let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. And so we see here that this really is the key to what's going on here, is that the Lord is wanting to make this place that is, you know, the center of worship, a center of where the Lord is to dwell. So again, I mean, we talked about how important this the tabernacle was to Israel going forward. It symbolized, again, God dwelling among his people. We're going to see in the last chapter of Exodus how God's glory was manifested there in the temple. We're going to see that also, and most importantly, that this tabernacle, it was really a picture of Christ, who, as we saw in John chapter 1, it says that Christ dwelt among his people. Let me just read that. I just love the way chapter 1 of John begins, where it talks about in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then what I was focusing on here is verse 14. And it's just so amazing how all these things fit together, isn't it? As we've been going through Genesis and Exodus, and it just illuminates the things that we read all the time. And we kind of, like, we just gloss over them sometimes. So, like, look at verse 14 in chapter 1 of John. It says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." And that word "dwelt" is, he tabernacled among us. "And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." And so we see that this tabernacle here is really a picture of Christ. And then we see later on him actually coming and tabernacling or dwelling among us. Now, the tabernacle has several different names, right? It is referred to as the sanctuary, meaning a sacred place. It's referred to as a tent. I'm sure many of you heard that, because it had it's going to have a tent-like structure. It was referred to also as the tent of meeting, because that was the structure. It was like a tent, and that was the purpose, is to meet. Also was called the tabernacle of the testimony and the tent of the testimony, and that is because ultimately it's the place where the two tables of the law, so we're going to see later on that Moses is going to be instructed to put the stone tablets that have the Ten Commandments on it into the Ark of the Covenant that would be there in the tabernacle. And so, going back to verse 8, I want to emphasize something. So verse 8 says, "And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." And the reality is that this is ultimately what the Lord desires. He wants to dwell among his people. He wants to be with us. And that is proven in Revelation. We saw that when we went through Revelation, chapter 21. And I'm going to read this. In chapter 21, it really shows that at the very end of it all, right, when it's all said and done, when God has things his way, we're going to see what takes place there. So let's see in Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 through 3. Look at what it says. And essentially now where we are here in Revelation chapter 21, we're in that place that I was talking about earlier, right? When I said, in Genesis, in the first few pages of Genesis, that's where things were the way the Lord wanted them to be. We messed it up, right? Man messed it up by sinning. And so then the Lord immediately in chapter 3, verse 15 of Genesis began to put a plan in place to get things right. And now in Revelation chapter 21, now he's got things back to the way they're supposed to be. And let's see what it looks like. It says, verse 1, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." That's the church. And it says, "And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they will be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God." That, as I said, is when it's all said and done, you can see the intention of God. His desire is this, is that he would be dwelling with us. And so we can see really just how significant what we're reading about here in Exodus 25, because the Lord is creating this, it's almost like when a kid has like a playhouse or whatever, right? You know, it's that kind of situation. It's not the real thing, but it's something that would depict something that's real, that once that child grows up, they're actually going to live in a house, and they'll, you know, so all the things that they're playing around with in that house, they'll have ultimately. And so that's really what the Lord is doing here. Verse 9, we see the first mention of where of what I said before, the instructions, the strict instruction that the Lord is giving to Moses. It says, "According to all that I show you, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all of its furnishings, just so you shall make it." And so he, for the first time here, he's emphasizing, I want you to build this tabernacle the way that I'm showing you, okay? You know, that show you really means that I let you see. So this is not the time for Moses to say, you know, the Lord said that we should do it this way, but I think it would be better if we did it this other way. You know, like we just add like some other colors. I mean, or we change the shape, or we put a few other articles in there or whatever. It's very important because it's a picture of something of a reality, and we don't want to mess up that picture. Okay. And so the Lord is saying, do it exactly the way I'm telling you to. Verse 10, "And they shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and a cubit and a half its width, and a cubit and a half its height." And so we see here that in terms of describing the furnishings or the articles that will go into this tabernacle, the Lord starts with the Ark of the Covenant. He starts with the most important thing in this tabernacle. And in essence, from God's perspective, what he's doing is he's starting in the middle, or starting with the thing that is most important, and he's going to work his way outwards from there. And so we're going to see here the way that he's describing the tabernacle. I mean, the Ark of the Covenant. You know, its size and so forth. And so first of all, we see that it's a chest. It's like a square object. And it's referred to as the Ark of the Testimony also, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. It's rectangular in shape. And it talks about its dimensions in verse 10 as being, you know, 2.5 cubits in length, and a cubit and a half in width, and a cubit and a half in height. And so, you know, the question is, what is a cubit, right? So what most people say that a cubit is, you know, the length from, you know, your elbow, you know, to the tip of your fingers, that generally people say that it's, you know, 18 inches. 18 inches is what most people would say is a cubit. And so using those dimensions, it would be 2 feet, 3 inches wide, and it would be 3 feet, 9 inches long, and it would be 2 feet, 3 inches high, using an 18-inch cubit. Again, it's made out of acacia wood, which we said is a very durable wood. It's precious, and it is, in verse 11, it says that, it says, and you shall overlay it with pure gold inside and out. You shall overlay it, and you shall make on it a molding of gold all around. And so here we see that it's you know, covered with gold. So, you know, we're using a lot of gold on this, and both on the outside of it and on the inside of it. Again, we said that the gold is a symbol or a picture of deity or holiness, okay? And so this Ark of the Covenant certainly has the gold covering it. It talks about having a molding of gold around it, which is, so it's sort of a crown of gold going around it. Verse 12, it says, you shall cast 4 rings of gold for it and put them in its 4 corners. 2 rings shall be on one side and 2 rings on the other. Verse 13, and you shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. Verse 14, you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark, that the ark may be carried by them. Verse 15, the poles shall be in the rings of the ark. They shall not be taken from it. And so we see here that on the 4 corners of this ark, there will be these rings there. And then they're going to have these poles that are also made of acacia wood, and they are also covered with gold, and that will slide into these poles, and they would stay there. And this is the way that they were to transport the Ark of the Covenant from place to place. And just one of the things that, you know, just that we'll get to probably, you know, years from now, Lord willing, is that it was really important how they transported the Ark of the Covenant. They had to transport it precisely the way that the Lord required, and they had, you know, it had to be transported by the right people, and so forth. And we saw there, if you are so inclined, you can read in First Chronicles chapter 13, where David was moving the Ark of the Covenant, and he, you know, failed to, you know, to move it the right way. Either he just forgot or didn't, or whatever the case is. But what he did was he put it on an ox to transport it. And putting it on an ox was the way that the Philistines moved the ark. There was a period of time when the Philistines came into possession of the ark. And so he was moving it the wrong way, which was a huge mistake. And when he was moving it, all of a sudden the ark started to fall off, and there was this person, Uzzah, who reached over and tried to steady that ark, and he just dropped dead. Okay, and so everything stopped. There's like, wait a second, we're doing something wrong. They realized that, but it just shows you that how holy, you know, and how serious all this was with regard to the Ark of the Covenant, and because it represents, which we're going to see as we go forward here. Verse 16, it says, "And you shall put the ark of the testimony, which I will give you, you shall put it into the ark of the, and you shall put into the ark of the testimony, which I will give you." And we're going to see, as I've already mentioned, that the two tables of stone that the law was written on would be placed into the Ark of the Covenant, along with other things. In fact, I believe it's in Hebrews, it talks about the fact that it would have some other things in there. So let's go on. Verse 17 says, "You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its width." And so here we see this cover, and this cover is going to be made out of pure gold. And its dimensions, this is basically the lid. It's the lid for the Ark of the Covenant. And it is basically, it's 2 feet by 3 inches wide and 3 feet 9 inches long. And it, as we can see in verse 18, it says, "And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold of hammered work. You shall make them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat." Verse 19, "Make 1 cherub at 1 end and the other cherub at the other end. You shall make the cherub at the 2 ends of it of 1 piece with the mercy seat." And verse 20, "And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above the covering, above covering the mercy seat with their wings, and they shall face one another. The faces of the cherubim shall be toward the mercy seat. And you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. And there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim, which are on the ark of the testimony, about everything which I will give you in commandments to the children of Israel." And so we see these golden cherubim that represent or they resemble the winged angels that are in God's presence, that they are actually in, as a matter of fact, in God's presence. And there are a few places where these cherubim are mentioned, one of which is in Ezekiel chapter 10. And there we can see that these cherubim have a face of a man, a face of a lion, an eagle, and an ox. And it also indicates that these cherubim are described as having 4 wings. And so it says here that they are to make these cherubim out of gold, you know, using hammered work here. And it's all made out of gold. And it's not like the Ark of the Covenant. You remember it was acacia wood, and then it was covered both on the outside and the inside with gold covered. This mercy seat, this covering, is actually made out of pure gold. And assuming, based upon the dimensions I gave, 2 feet 3 inches by 3 feet 9 inches. If that covering was 1 inch thick, the weight of it would have been 750 pounds. Okay, so you kind of get a sense for how how heavy all of this stuff is. And also we can take note of the fact that, you know, because they were to put those poles into the Ark of the Covenant, that the whole idea we're going to see is that this tabernacle was portable. You know, they could, you know, break it down and they could move, and then they can then put everything back together again. So when they're carrying that Ark of the Covenant, it's no small feat, right? It's very heavy. But of critical importance is that, you know, above the atonement cover and between the two cherubim, as it said here in, verse 22, God, it says that God would meet with his people there. And so on the Day of Atonement, you know, the high priest, when he would go into the most holy place, he would sprinkle blood on the lid of that mercy seat. And that blood, it served as an atonement, right, or a covering for the sin of Israel. And again, as you can tell, where I'm probably going with this, it's symbolizing what would later be accomplished by Jesus, right? When he, as the Lamb of God, made atonement for the sin of the world, the entire world, when he shed his blood. And so this Ark of the Covenant, this mercy seat and everything, that is like super, super important. And that is, again, the very first thing that that is described in the tabernacle. Well, I'm going to stop there. We're going to be continuing on for the next few chapters, describing all of these different instruments or furnishings for the tabernacle, and talking about, you know, what they really mean and so forth. And so we'll take our time as we move through this, and we'll pick up next week where we left off.